appointed committee with a staff of current judges led by the current Minister of Justice. But the second segment that is really acting in complete shock, but also anger and outrage, is young people. And this is a very young society where, of course, we have a vast majority, demographic majority of people who are under 30. So many, many people on social media are just simply too young to remember, did not watch the news coverage at the time, did not know what happened. They know about the events as the Rabaa events. They don't even have a grasp of really what actually happened. So again, they're acting with the natural shock because, frankly, you know, we were there and we went through this and observed it. And even to us, it came as a shock to read these official testimonies. The prime minister at the time, Hazem Biblawi, has given testimony in that report where he says, again, on the record, that the number of those killed that day was below their expectations, the expectations of the planners of this dispersal. So it's really hard for the government now to stick to its false narrative for the last 10 years that it only acted out of necessity after facing fire from armed protesters. To your question about where the Muslim Brotherhood is right now, many of the senior leadership are, of course, in prison or serving sentences. But the entire leadership structure of the organization is now based out of Turkey and Europe and elsewhere. Of course, the young, the rank and file members of Muslim Brotherhood and beyond, people who are just either supporters of former President Mohamed Morsi or simply accused of being are now in the thousands in prison, with the most conservative number being, around 30,000 of them.
Hossam, we just have a minute, but two quick questions. The people who are on death row now, if you can give us some sense of who they are, and you yourself, I mean, President Sisi may be reconsidering keeping you in Egypt, but your own circumstances for people to understand something we came to understand well in Sharm el-Sheikh, that you cannot leave the country, based on what?
I've been, together with other colleagues from the human rights movement, under investigation for 10 years now, over 10 years. And for the last 7 years, as part of that investigation, as a precautionary measure, I have been placed under an open-ended travel ban with my assets frozen and my bank account frozen since then. As I said before, I consider myself lucky still that this is the small price that I have to pay. But I'm also in no rush to leave Egypt. I can't deny the influence, the impact of these unfair measures against me and my colleagues. But at the same time, you know, we've been around and, we've changed four administrations and presidents now, and we've outlasted them. So we know that this will ultimately come to an end. And if it doesn't, we want to have contributed to bringing this to an end.
Hossam Bakhat, I want to thank you so much for being with us, founder and executive director of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, EIPR. He is based in Cairo. He's also worked as investigative journalist with the independent media outlet Matamasser. And you can go to democracynow.org and see our interview in the offices of Matamasser when we were in Egypt. Coming up, the UN Security Council has met to discuss the Azerbaijani blockade of Nagorno-Karabakh and calls for the immediate reopening of the Lachin Corridor to allow for humanitarian aid for the roughly 120,000 people suffering severe shortages. We'll speak with the former International Criminal Court prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, who says the blockade amounts to a likely genocide. Stay with us.
Hey ايه العمل الظلم صار مش محتمل والحد امتى هيبقى ويعيش الامل وسط الرصاص انا بتعصر ايوة صحيح مش بنكسر لكن ساعات في اليأس والخوف بتأسر فين الخلاص الخلاص هو يقيني اننا نقدر نعود وان صوت الحق عالي وانه اقوى من البارود شوف الوشوش كم وش منهم مش بشوش بتحق وضع كالوه قالوا
What to do by Yasser Amanoghali. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The UN Security Council met Wednesday to discuss the blockade imposed by Azerbaijan in Nagorno-Karabakh as Armenia and other nations called for the immediate reopening of the Lechin Corridor to allow for humanitarian aid for the roughly 120,000 people suffering severe shortages in the breakaway region. 23-year-old English teacher Nina Shavardian, a resident of Nagorno-Karabakh, described life under the blockade.
We don't have gas, we have electricity blackouts. So, for example, at 5 o'clock, we will have a blackout again, so we'll not have electricity for 2 hours, and then this is repeating itself. We don't have water because we have only one water reservoir, which is used right now to produce electricity. And it's not enough, so right now we have also water shortages. And because of the water shortages and electricity shortages and no gas, the bakeries don't work, so there is not enough bread even in the shops.
That was Nina Shavardian. She also noted there's a shortage of fuel, further isolating those who are not able to walk or walk long distances. A recent report by former International Criminal Court prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo found the blockade amounts to a likely genocide of the local Armenian population. Azerbaijan has rejected the accusation. Tensions have been running high in Nagorno-Karabakh since December of last year when the blockade started. The crossing has been totally sealed off since mid-June. The population of the disputed region is majority Armenian, but it's part of Azerbaijan after Azerbaijani forces regained control of the territory in the 2020 war, leaving the Lechin Corridor as the area's only connector with Armenia.
Well, for more, we're joined by two guests. In Boston, Anna Ohanian, professor of political science and international relations at Stonehill College, is joining us. Her latest book is The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Eurasia. And joining us from the capital of Colombia, Bogota, Luis Moreno Ocampo, Argentine lawyer who served as the first prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. He also was the deputy prosecutor in Argentina's trial of the juntas. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Luis Moreno Ocampo, we last had you on with the Oscar-nominated film Argentina 1985, which was about the trial of the junta against the leaders of the Argentine coup led by Jorge Rafael Videla. Right now, you're talking about Azerbaijan. Can you talk about your findings?
It's very basic. Some Armenian people ask my expert opinion. I have experience. I prosecute for genocide, President Bashir for Darfur genocide. And it's very simple because the facts are exposed by the International Court of Justice, who said to Azerbaijan they cannot blockade the corridor that provides food and other essentials to the Armenians living in the region of Nagorno-Karabakh. So it's very basic. I just, the fact that are there, it's just saying the king is naked. You know what? The International Court of Justice say Azerbaijan is blocking the essentials for the life of these Armenian people, And that's exactly what Article 2C of the Genocide Convention say. The genocide has different forms to be committed. Killing massive numbers, one, A, but C, require no results. It's just creating conditions to destroy the life of the group. And that is what happened today in Azerbaijan. That's why it's funny because it's like a shock, but it's obvious. It's a genocide today. The question is now, not debate genocide. The question is prevent the killings, prevent the death of these people. You present one of the victims. In a few minutes, I will be in a press conference with the people of Nagorno-Karabakh by Zoom. So they are there and they are dying. So what we do? And that's a question, because I was listening to your show, and when you have a national crime, you have judges and prosecutors. When George Floyd was killed, you have judges and prosecutors. Here, there is no judge or prosecutor for this genocide case, because the International Criminal Court has no jurisdiction. So the UN Security Council is the only global institution who can solve the problem. And the problem there is there are tensions today, as obvious, between Russia, US, and France. These are the three key actors. If they agreed how to manage the problem, they stop this genocide in 1 minute. And that's why it's interesting. Here, the solution is very, very simple. It's an agreement between the US, France, and Russia to stop the genocide. It's easy. And my last point is, Ukraine is a big conflict, it's a big crime, but Armenian victims could not be collateral damage of the Ukrainian conflict. Could not be. We should not accept a new Armenian genocide in 2023.
Could you explain, elaborate on that point, what you mean when you say that the Armenians who are stuck in Nagorno-Karabakh should not be collateral damage of the war in Ukraine? If you could talk about that. And then also you say that you based your decision on your findings on the decision taken by the International Court of Justice earlier this year. Explain what that decision was. It was legally binding. And what followed that decision? What happened as a result of what the International Court of Justice found?
Okay, starting from the second question, the International Court of Justice, which is a court who deals between states, received a request from Armenia against Azerbaijan based not on genocide convention, based on a treaty that forbids discrimination. So the International Court of Justice is not analyzing genocide. It's analyzing a different treaty against discrimination. But in this case, since February, for the last 6 months, the International Court of Justice gave a binding order to Azerbaijan to free the blockade of what is called the Lachin Corridor that provided food and the essentials for the life of the Armenians in Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan is refusing. In fact, it's still off completely since June. And that was not just Isaac, the International Court of Justice say. In July 26th, the Red Cross say that. Since June, we cannot move nothing from the Lachin Corridor. So that are the facts. And this is genocide creating the conditions. The solution, as I said before, and why the Armenians are collateral victims? Because the solution is an agreement between US, Russia, and France. If they agree that they will stop this, they will do it. Because they cannot agree, they just call for negotiation. Remember, in the Rwanda time, an ambassador said, calling on negotiations in Srebrenica, when they talk about the Balkans. So talking about negotiation is to asking the Jews in the concentration camps to negotiate with Hitler. That is. So this is a good moment. It's a time for President Biden to transform and stop a genocide. We have great people in power. President Biden is the first president, U.S. president, who recognized Armenia 1915 was a genocide. Yesterday, the Armenian ambassador in the UN Security Council meeting said, we need not just commemoration, we need prevention. And what Secretary of State Blinken, who has a family affected, and we have Samantha Power, who really wrote the most important book on how to prevent genocide. But Samantha Power, in her book, says something very important. She explained how every time a genocide happened, since 1950, through the Jewish genocide, there's always reason to not be involved, the denial. How many efforts the political leaders are doing to deny the genocide. And that's why my report was basic, say, the king is naked. It's a genocide. Now, the solution is political. The leader has to agree to stop the genocide. That's a chance.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to bring in Professor Anna Ohanian, a professor of political science and international relations at Stonehill College. Professor Ohanian, if you could respond to the ongoing crisis in Nagorno-Karabakh and what you understand occurred at the meeting, Wednesday's meeting of the UN Security Council yesterday.
In addition to the severe humanitarian crisis that the blockade, the siege of Nagorno-Karabakh Republic by Azerbaijan has created, the genocidal violence essentially that has created, as described by Mr. Ocampo, it also is taking place in the context of broader use of violence in the region. In 2020, when Azerbaijan, with Turkey's backing, engaged in an offensive on the Nagorno-Karabakh entity, Azerbaijan was victorious, emerged victorious, recovered the territory surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh, as well as parts of Nagorno-Karabakh. The November 9 agreement, as your previous speaker mentioned, created and maintained the Lachin corridor connecting Nagorno-Karabakh with Armenia. What this peace process has been continuing since then by the Western European Union. United States has been very, very active. This is in parallel with Russia's continued attempt to remain relevant and provide security with its peacekeeping troops inside Nagorno-Karabakh. But what is transpiring with the siege, with the blockade, the use of hunger as a weapon is demonstrating is that Baku's strategy is to consolidate the victory it has achieved in the battlefield through the use of non-kinetic, tools that are not directly violent, such as the weapon as a hunger, in order to coerce the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh conflict to either relocate, soft ethnic cleansing, or to fully submit to Azerbaijan, which Azerbaijan government refers to as integration. The key here, I think Baku's objective is to not engage, to not provide political accommodation to the entity. And this is an entity that has been a de facto state, has been a self-governing unit since the first Nagorno-Karabakh War ended in 1994. And it was part of, as a result of Stalin's gerrymandering, this entity was given to Soviet Azerbaijan. But even then, as part of Soviet Azerbaijan, it was an autonomous republic self-governing. So the siege, the hunger, is an attempt to eliminate, to not engage with the entity politically. And in that respect, it's quite dangerous. Using hunger as a weapon essentially creates the conditions of hybrid war. And as such, it's very dangerous, not just for the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, but also for other conflict regions in general. Much more recently, that strategy was also used in Ethiopia relative to the Tigray population in its north. So it's quite troublesome as to what is happening, and it's devastating also because there is an opportunity that Azerbaijan has in moving towards pacifying the region. There are various actors involved, and this historic opportunity, considering that Russia has weakened, creates an opening in moving the region forward. And as such, it is a historic opportunity because Russia, for almost a century, has been using interethnic cleavages to, you know, tensions to remain relevant. So geopolitical stakes of a peaceful, principled, dignified resolution of this conflict remain significant.
Anna Ohanian, want to thank you for being with us, professor of political science and international relations at Stonehill College, joining us from Boston. And Luis Moreno Ocampo, Argentine lawyer who served as the first prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. He also was the deputy prosecutor in Argentina's trial of the Juntas. This is Democracy Now! Coming up, The Intercept reports a secret Pakistan cable documents U.S. pressure to remove Imran Khan as prime minister. Stay with us.
रहता नहीं ना जाने क्यों तू ही तू दिल में बसाए तेरे बिना क्या जीऊं बिखरा ये मन क्या सितम तूने हटाए फिर भी मैं कुछ ना कहूं शिकार में ये तो पता तुझे है भला सब है तेरे इख्तियार में
Ikra by the Pakistani musician Abdul Hassan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with a new report by The Intercept. Secret Pakistan cables document U.S. pressure to remove Imran Khan. It follows up on their recent story that begins, quote, the U.S. State Department encouraged the Pakistani government in a March 7, 2022 meeting to remove Imran Khan as prime minister over his position on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The cable describes a meeting between the Pakistani ambassador to the United States and two State Department officials that Imran Khan has repeatedly cited as leading to his political ouster after a no-confidence vote in parliament believed to have been organized with the backing of Pakistan's powerful military. The meeting came after then-Prime Minister Imran Khan arrived in Russia on the eve of its invasion of Ukraine last February 2022. He could be heard telling a Russian official, "What a time I have come. So much excitement," as he arrived in Moscow's airport. On the day Russia ordered the invasion, Khan went ahead with his scheduled meeting with President Putin.
The State Department officials present at the meeting, described in the secret cable now published by The Intercept, included Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, and Asad Majid Khan, who at the time was Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. The cable says Liu raised the issue of the no-confidence vote, quote, "I think if the no-confidence vote against the prime minister succeeds, all will be forgiven in Washington because the Russia visit is being looked at as a decision by the prime minister," unquote. Liu continued, quote, "Otherwise, I think it would be tough going ahead," and said Khan could face isolation by Europe and the U.S. should he remain in office. For more, we're joined by Murtaza Hussain, senior writer at The Intercept. Can you lay out what you have found?
So this document has been the center of Pakistan's political crisis for the past year and a half. For the first time, we've actually seen what it says, and what it seems to reveal is very extraordinary pressure which is put by the U.S. on Imran Khan over his stance on Ukraine, which in that document, U.S. officials referred to as aggressively neutral. So shortly after this meeting depicted in this document, known as a cipher in Pakistan, took place, Imran Khan was removed from power in a no-confidence vote, which State Department officials had not just encouraged, but actually threatened Pakistan over, that should Khan survive that vote, Pakistan would be isolated, and should he be removed, quote, all would be forgiven. So Khan himself had been saying for the past year and a half, since his removal, that U.S. officials had played a very integral role in encouraging the Pakistani military to take him out of power. And now that we've seen this document for the first time, it does seem to validate many of his claims about the events which led up to his removal from power last year.
Well, I'd like to go, Murtaza, to a political activist, Asim Sajjad Akhtar, who Democracy Now! Spoke to on Wednesday. We got his response. He's a long-time left-wing political activist, and we got his response to the report in The Intercept. This is part of what he said.
I think the Intercept story is much ado about nothing, at least in Pakistan. That's, and I'm talking about critical progressive circles. I'm not talking about government or the PTI or IK supporters. The truth is that IK fell out with the military, and that's the reason he was booted. I mean, what he really wanted to say was that Bajwa wanted me out, but he couldn't say that at the time, as the right tends to do everywhere. And IK is a classic example of a populist right-wing demagogue. Steals the anti, he's not even anti-imperialist, but he at best could have called himself anti-American. And of course, we didn't have the kind of, or don't have the kind of purchase, especially in the mainstream media, to be able to say, well, no, a real anti-imperialist looks and does, you know, X, Y, Z.
So that's Asim Sajjad Akhtar, left-wing political activist in Pakistan. If you could respond with us to what he said, and also, you know, a question that's been raised a lot in the Pakistani media, namely that Pakistan had already long been isolated well before this. I mean, Biden didn't even give Imran Khan a call after he was elected. So if you could respond.
Well, first thing to understand, it's a very polarized political environment in Pakistan, perhaps more so than it's been in many, many decades. So people's perceptions of this reflect that polarization inside Pakistani society. I think looking at Pakistani history, one thing which is undeniable is that the military does not make a move. The U.S. is effectively part of the governing compact of Pakistani society. At the time this meeting took place, Imran Khan was already on thin ice with the military. He'd fallen out with them after initially having his rise sponsored in part by their support. But as we see in this document, the military was waiting in many ways for some sort of green light from the U.S. Had they not gotten that green light, or have the U.S. said that we have no position on Pakistan's internal politics, it's much harder to imagine the subsequent events that took place. And one thing which is very important that we learn from this, the disclosure, is that it specifically was about the war in Ukraine and Pakistan's foreign policy, which is usually part of the military's ambit. And after Khan was removed, we didn't just see a change of power, we saw a very distinct change in Pakistan's stance on the Ukraine conflict. Just a few days before he was removed, General Bajwa actually gave a speech contradicting Khan's stance, which was very neutral on the Ukraine conflict. And now Pakistan has emerged as a major supplier of arms to the Ukrainian military, brokered by the United States. So you have to take it into the broader context of what's taken place in the year and a half since he's removed from power. And now Mr. Khan, who polls show is the most popular politician in Pakistan one way or another, is specifically being jailed and banned from politics to prevent him from taking part in elections expected for later this year. So what we're seeing right now is a very thoroughgoing development towards a full-blown military dictatorship in Pakistan, which is taking place with the support of ostensibly democratic parties who have co-signed the marginalization of democracy in Pakistan for many years to come.
Murtaza Hussain, I want to thank you so much for being with us, senior writer at The Intercept. We're going to link to his piece, Secret Pakistan Cable Documents U.S. Pressure to Remove Imran Khan. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the design and communications manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of a community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.